And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we're coming at you live like every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. If you're listening live, you want to join in our chat room at podcastufo.com. It's an easy sign-in. We have an amazing show for you this evening. Alejandro Rojas is coming right up from Open Minds with the UFO news. Our guest tonight is astrophysicist Jeffrey Bennett. And I had the pleasure of listening to him speak last year, and he's an amazing talent, and you're going to love him. And I guess we're ready to roll right into the news right now. How you doing, Alejandro?
I am doing great, and I love Jeffrey Bennett, so that's going to be a lot of fun. And pin him down on what his beliefs on UFOs are really interesting.
Oh, I plan to.
Yeah, you're going to do it.
So what's going on?
All right, there's a lot going on, some really cool news, and I think one of the best pieces of news just came out yesterday. It is a Huffington Post blog by Leslie Kane, where she's writing a report about a meeting that happened July 31st in Chile, where the Chilean government reviewed whether or not UFOs pose a threat to their military air operations. They have an organization that officially investigates UFOs called the Committee for the Studies of Anomalous Aerial Phenomena, called CEPA-A. It's a part of their Ministerial Department of Civil Aeronautics, which is equivalent to our FAA, but they also work closely with the Chilean Air Force. So the CEPA-A brought these guys together, some officials with the DGAC, some scientists, psychologists, and some military personnel, a lot of people, and they sat down to talk about this topic. They posted a video that you can see, too, where you could see they're dead serious. And Leslie Kane talks about how strange it is, you know, to be in a place where they take UFOs so seriously. In fact, she says everybody who came to the meeting already had established that UFOs are a real phenomena worthy of study. So that's already a foregone conclusion before they even get to the meeting. They reviewed cases and talked about the state of things. They thought that UFOs deserve more study because they do feel that there's an intelligence behind them. They want to know what the motives of this intelligence is. But they determined that so far, that from what they've been able to see through their UFO reports, is that there is no malicious intent, that UFOs do not pose a threat. The only threat is possible distraction by pilots by looking at UFOs. So they figured, you know, maybe some more education of pilots on UFOs will kind of limit that surprise factor when they do see something. So terribly, terribly interesting story.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I wonder, this is a little bit like back in 1969 when Project Blue Book determined that UFOs were not a threat to the national security. But they also said that you know, they were no longer interested. And the differences with Chile, obviously, is that they are still interested.
Yeah, they are still interested. They would disagree as far as the conclusion that, like the Condon report came up with, that there was no scientific value in looking at UFOs. They feel that there is, and of course, many do. And also, you know, in 1969, a lot of people coming to the table didn't believe in UFOs. But what a lot of people don't know is that there were a lot of military people who did, who even believed they were extraterrestrial in nature. But yeah, all of these people are coming to the table that this is a real phenomena that is really an unknown intelligence.
Yeah, it's always interesting to actually see when countries take things seriously. And, you know, it's a real good example. I hope that someone in the United States government that has some type of involvement with what's going on is paying attention a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what's really important with meetings like this and really getting down to the details of how they happen, because it's a demonstration of how they could happen here should some governmental agency decide to take on the topic.
Yeah, when pigs fly, as they say.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I know Leslie's hopeful, and that's her intent. But like you say, it's a long shot.
Yeah, right. Okay, so what else is going on this week?
Well, hopefully some of these really cool sightings out there will help prompt one of these governmental agencies, because there have been some really cool sightings. Incidentally, all of these are in other countries. For example, there was a picture taken over Edinburgh Castle. There's a picture taken in Australia. But the one I want to talk in more particular about is a picture taken in Canada. And that was taken on August 10th, so just recently, just a few days ago. And this was a MUFON report written up by Roger Marsh. You know, we've been posting those on our website. And this person says they saw a large V-shaped object similar to the Phoenix Lights. And they took a picture. And in the picture, it is difficult to see, and they do try to enhance the picture on one portion. But you do see these three bluish lights and a V-shaped formation. And, you know, MUFON's taking this case pretty seriously, and it does look very interesting. So it's a really cool sighting. So I implore people to go check out some of these recent sightings. Most of the time, I get accused of being a debunker because they turn out to be, you know, satellites or LEDs or something like that. But these ones are truly mysterious that we've got up here this week. So it's been a great week for sightings.
That's great. Did they happen to say what they felt the size of this thing was?
They said they felt it was large, and I think that's about it. There wasn't a whole lot of witness testimony in this case, but of course what MUFON will do is go do a follow-up investigation, and Roger is really good in a couple months following up, and when that case is closed, we'll be sure to do an update for people.
Yeah, great, great. So we got one more story, right?
Yeah, one more story. And I added this. I could have talked about another sighting, but I think this is important. I wanted to talk to you about kind of this topic. And it is celebrity opinion, which I think is very important, because I feel we really take – people take their social cues from celebrities. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, adulthood is not much different than high school, where everybody's trying to be like the cool kid.
Yeah.
And plus – I know that you're a sucker for a pretty face, and I don't know that there's many prettier faces out there. And this is Megan Fox. So she was doing an interview with MTV about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, which came out on Friday. And I guess it did great at the box office this weekend. But MTV's Josh Horowitz pointed out that her character, like, I guess, April O'Neil, which is her character in the movie, that Megan Fox also believes in the paranormal. And she right off the bat rolls her eyes and is like, oh, here we go. And she even gets kind of snotty with him. And she's like, okay, so you're talking about Bigfoot. And I don't think that it's too strange that there could be this big animal out there that we haven't found yet, because it's intelligent enough not to be found. So he kind of laughs and he says, well, what about UFOs? Do you believe in those? And she says, yes, she believes in them 1,000%. And she's like, how can someone not believe? And I think she makes another great point, which is, if they are a more advanced species, why would we be able to find them if they don't want to be found? And what's interesting is Megan Fox, who people think is just, you know, some starlet airbrain, actually, you're going to hear Jeffrey Bennett say something very similar to what she just said there. In fact, maybe she's familiar with Bennett's work, because I agree with that point so much. But otherwise, then he asked her about ghosts, and she said, yeah, I believe in all of that stuff. And she went on to talk about a ghost story. But I think that's a great point that she made, a couple of great points. And I think it's important that she had some valid and intelligent points. And I think people will feel more open, you know, to talk about stuff when celebrities do.
Absolutely. You know, you think of Dan Aykroyd. He's another one. He's that really you've actually talked to him. I saw you in a picture with him before. So I would love to get him on the show. And Megan Fox will be on the show next week. All right. I'm kidding.
Well, that would be great. And if you'll definitely have to do a video interview if that's the case.
Yes. Well, if I do a video interview, I will need help with lighting. So I'll.
Excellent! Yeah. I am there in a heartbeat.
You were talking earlier about threat by distraction, right? All right. Hey, thanks a lot, Alejandro.
All right. Thank you so much.
And I'll be talking to you next week.
Yep. Visit openminds.tv to see all these stories. Adios.
And by the way, these links will be in our show notes for today's story. And coming right up, right after the quick music break, is Jeffrey Bennett. Jeffrey Bennett, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me on here, Martin.
Yes, you know, I saw you talk down at the conference in North Carolina, and I was totally glued to the subject. I loved listening to you talk, and I was thrilled that you'd be on the show. You know, I want to start off, you know, we can go into your background a little bit, but first of all, I told you that I was going to ask you about the Big Bang Theory, because that's, we're going to talk about UFOs and all kinds of things, but the Big Bang Theory kind of, you know, I don't really have an opinion on it. I'm not a scientist like you, but I know that, you know, it goes against the laws of, say, thermodynamics. There's some redshift stuff going on out there that doesn't make any sense. We have to invent dark energy, all this, to make the Big Bang Theory work. And then somehow the Large Hadron Collider comes into being able to prove something. I want to talk about what your thoughts are on the Big Bang Theory in general.
You bet. And as it turns out, I've just written a book that came out a couple of months ago that covers all of these topics. It's called What is Relativity? So it's all about Einstein's special and general theories of relativity. And the Big Bang actually comes almost directly out of Einstein's theory. And without going into the details right now, the basic idea is that according to relativity, which is the most well-tested theory in all of science, it's what makes your GPS work, for example. If relativity had even the slightest error, your GPS unit would get you lost. And relativity says that the universe has to be either expanding or contracting. It cannot be static. And Hubble, in 1929, discovered that the universe is expanding. So there you can see the basic idea coming out of relativity. It's got to be expanding or contracting. The evidence shows the universe is expanding. And the Big Bang emerges almost immediately from that fact. Because if the universe is expanding, that means it was smaller in the past. And therefore, if you run the expansion backwards, you're going to have to get to a point where it began, since once everything's on top of everything else, you can't be any smaller than that. So the Big Bang is in some ways a misnomer. It's not an explosion, despite the name. All it is it's the term that we use for the moment when the expansion started. And because of that, it doesn't actually violate any of the laws that we know of thermodynamics or anything else, because we're not trying to answer with this the question of what came before, because we're only tracing the expansion back to its beginning. What happened before the expansion started is something we know nothing about today.
So now, pardon me, in a nutshell, would you say the expansion is something out of nothing?
That we don't really know yet. But what I'll point out to you is that the reason that scientists like the idea of the Big Bang today, and I'll put it in the terms that I'll use for UFOs also. In science, we try not to ever say we believe in something. We only talk about where the evidence points. Mm-hmm. And there's three lines of evidence that all point very strongly to the idea that there was a beginning to the expansion and a beginning to the universe. The first one is, as you use telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope or any other telescope, and you look out into the universe, the farther away you look, the further back in time you're looking, because that light took a long time to reach you. So, for example, we say the universe is about 14 billion years old today. So if you look at a galaxy 7 billion light years away, you're seeing it as it was 7 billion years ago, when the universe was only half its current age. So if the Big Bang really happened, then that means galaxies very far away, we should be seeing them as they were when they were younger than the galaxies that we see nearby. And when we study these galaxies in detail, it's very clear that they are indeed younger than the ones nearby. So that agrees with the idea that the universe had a beginning. The second line of evidence is that when you run the expansion backwards, you're compressing everything in the universe. And as you know, like from a bicycle pump, when you compress a piston, it makes things hotter. So when you run the expansion backwards to see what things were like in the early universe, you come to the conclusion that the very early universe had to be extremely hot, and hot things radiate. And back in the 1940s originally, and then with more detail over the 50s and 60s, people realized that if the Big Bang really happened, there should be this radiation filling the universe. And it was discovered in the 1960s. It's been measured very, very carefully by satellites like COBE and WMAP and Planck most recently. And every measured characteristic of this cosmic background radiation matches exactly what you would predict if there really was a Big Bang. Mm-hmm. And then the third line of evidence is that once you understand that temperature of the early universe, you can calculate the rate at which fusion would have made hydrogen, which is just protons, into other elements. And what you find is that the conditions were only right for hydrogen to fuse into helium, not into anything else. And the calculations show in a very simple way that you expect 25% of the hydrogen to have turned into helium, so that the universe should be 75% hydrogen and 25% helium by mass. And when you measure the composition of the universe in every direction you look, in every galaxy that we see, that's exactly what it is. So we have three lines of evidence that all say, yes, the universe really did have a beginning 14 billion years ago.
Now, would you consider that there's any evidence against it? And, well, I'm going to ask a two-part question. That and how would you explain dark matter?
Good question. So there is no evidence against the Big Bang that we are aware of. However, there are mysteries that this simple idea of an expanding universe doesn't yet explain. The first mystery is what is dark matter? And the second big mystery is what is dark energy? We can talk about those a little bit more if you want, but neither one of those actually changes the basic idea and the basic evidence. They just introduce new elements, which we're going to have to explain in addition to the things that the Big Bang seems to explain already.
Okay. Well, we don't have to dwell on that exactly. You know,
it's fun, though.
But one of the things that I'd like for you to talk about is, and I heard you talk about this in North Carolina, is why there has to be life out there. Can you just kind of go into that a little bit? And by the way, anyone listening live, you can jump right over to podcastufo.com and join right in our chat room.
Well, the reason I say that there has to be life out there, you know, there's a couple of different reasons. I can go through some of the science, and I'll do that in a moment. But on a more fundamental level, one of the things that's happened in the history of science is a long, long time ago, we thought we were really special, that we lived on a world that was the center of the universe, which therefore meant we were also the center of the universe. And throughout history, we've been learning every time that that's not quite right. First, we learned that Earth is a planet going around the sun, not the center of the universe. Then we learned that the sun is not the center of the galaxy, just one of 100 billion stars in the galaxy. Then we learned that our galaxy is not the whole universe, that there's 100 billion other galaxies in the universe. So we've, through history, kept learning that there's nothing particularly special about us. And given the vast number of other worlds that are out there, to me, it just would seem almost impossible to believe that this could be the only place where life is. You might remember from Carl Sagan's novel and movie Contact, where they said what a waste of space that would be if we were the only life. So I think right off the bat, it's going to seem to almost anyone who looks at the size of the universe that there's got to be other life. But now we can investigate it in more detail scientifically. We can look at the question of, are there really other planets that are capable of having conditions like Earth on which they could have life? And in the last couple of years, thanks to the Kepler mission, we have discovered dozens of such planets, and the statistics show that there must be at least 40 billion or more such planets in our galaxy alone. And then you can say, well, if you have the conditions for life, will you get life? And that requires understanding the origin of life on Earth. And while we don't know exactly how life on Earth started, and perhaps we never will, what we do know from laboratory experiments today is that it seems like it wasn't that difficult. The molecules that make life form easily under the natural conditions that existed on the early Earth. So you put all those ideas together, and you're going to just be led to the conclusion that you expect life to be common throughout the universe.
Now, one of the things that, you know, a lot of people that are skeptical of the subject that, or I should say the question of, are we being visited or is it possible that we're being visited? Now, I know that you made a scale model of the solar system, and can you talk a little bit about that? Because the distance between your scale model and where the first star would be is quite amazing. Can you just talk about that?
Sure. So we've built the, my colleague Jeff Goldstein and I are behind a project where we put the Voyager scale model solar system on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. And we have a half a dozen other communities that have replicas of the model. And we're actually looking for many more. So hopefully people out there will be thinking about that. But what we do is we build the solar system on a scale of 1 to 10 billion. So we're shrinking everything down 10 billion times. And on that scale, the sun becomes about the size of a large grapefruit, and Earth becomes smaller than the ballpoint in a pen. And Earth on that scale is located about 15 meters from the sun, 16 and a half yards. So you can kind of picture that. Picture a big grapefruit with 16 yards away, a tiny little ballpoint located, and that's going around it in a circle once a year. And that's kind of what our orbit around the sun looks like. Now, if you keep walking through the solar system, of course, between Earth and the sun, you'll find Mercury and Venus. Once you walk past the Earth, you'll encounter Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And we actually have Pluto in the model, so we'll continue on to Pluto. And you'll have walked a total of about a third of a mile from the sun to Pluto on this scale. Now, remember, Pluto, we have not yet sent a spacecraft past, but we have one on the way. It will go past next July, the New Horizons mission. It's the fastest thing humans have ever built. It's traveling 50,000 kilometers per hour. And that journey from Earth to Pluto is still a 9-year journey. Hmm. But in this model, it's only a third of a mile. It's a few minutes to walk. Where's the next star? On this same scale, the next star is 2,500 miles away, the distance across the United States. So in order for aliens to be visiting us from other stars, and they're not coming from our own solar system, we've photographed every major world in the solar system in enough detail now that if there were any cities or anything, we'd have seen them by now. So any visiting aliens have to be coming from other star systems. And that means they're traveling on this scale, the equivalent of across the United States, when it takes us 9 years to send a spaceship a third of a mile, and the farthest a human being has ever gone from Earth to the moon on this scale is barely over an inch.
So the furthest a human being is that what you're just saying on this scale?
Yes, on this scale.
And then the furthest, the nearest star, and you would,
right,
you'd consider that there's a lot more stars out there. And for the nearest star to actually harbor life would be, you know, another statistic that would be hard to figure out.
Well, and if someone has the technology to be doing that, they'd presumably be traveling to lots of different star systems, so they'd be getting around, right? So the point is, from my perspective, it's certainly possible. In fact, I would say likely that intelligent aliens have already built spaceships capable of doing just what we described. But we have to recognize that that means the level of the technology they have is so far beyond us that, you know, you couldn't even contrast us with the Neanderthals on that. You'd have to contrast us with, like, ants in order
or
to see the relative level of technology.
Right. You know, this is the one thing I really like about you, is that you're open-minded enough to look at the subject this way, because a lot of scientists that I've spoke to in the past are just saying, no, it defies the laws of physics, or it doesn't defy the law of physics, but the ages of the beings and, you know, would have to be astronomical, and as well as energy. There couldn't be enough energy to propel. But you have an open enough mind to realize that they may know something about physics that we don't, and their intelligent level may be so superior that they have this thing figured out.
Right. I have this debate with my colleagues fairly often about energy limitations and all those other kinds of things. And, you know, my main point is there's probably a lot that we have not yet discovered that presumably they have. So it seems perfectly reasonable to me that there could all be all sorts of solutions that they've come up with that we would not be aware even exist. You know, you go back 100 years ago and tell people that you're going to be able to talk over the telephone without any wires and from a little handheld device, and they would think you were crazy, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things I read in your bio basically is the thoughts of, you know, technology, where it's going, and how, you know, we're on the edge, or we can be on the edge fairly quickly as far as our civilization wiping it out. You know, it's a possibility. As our technology grows, we have to socially grow with it in order to stay intact. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. One of the reasons that the subtitle of my book, Beyond UFOs, is the search for extraterrestrial life and its astonishing implications to our future is because this subject really does open up your mind to thinking about our place in what you might think of as a history of civilizations. And this is not a new idea. It's been around ever since Frank Drake wrote his equation initially 60 years ago. And it's very simple when you start to think about how would we ever become a civilization that would travel among the stars, which if someone else is doing it, means they've already successfully passed that point. You realize that it's a very difficult thing to achieve, not because the technology is impossible or anything like that, but because the very same technologies that will help us eventually go to the stars are the technologies that we can also use to destroy ourselves. And the real question, and you can see it in the news every day right now, is will we use the technology in a way that puts us back to the Stone Age before we use it in a way that takes us out to the stars?
Wow, yeah. That's a profound statement and a real true one. When you are someone, wait a minute, we have a chat room, Jeffrey, and someone asked a question when we were talking all the way back about dark energy and dark matter. And I was just, I guess the question was, how do you explain the acceleration of the expansion? How do you explain that in general?
Right. So that's a great question. So we have a name for what causes the acceleration of the expansion. That's what we call dark energy. But the truth is, we have absolutely no idea what it is or how it works. So it is one of the greatest mysteries in science right now. What could it possibly be that's causing the universe's expansion to accelerate like that? We don't know. Whoever figures it out will get a Nobel Prize.
That's right. Now, when you are, you said you were more or less having discussions with colleagues. How do they feel about your stand on, you know, say the UFO topic in general?
Well, I would say the vast majority of them agree with me. They think that life is very, very likely, that intelligent life is very, very likely, that intelligent life, the place where you have the most philosophical questions is, do any civilizations survive this sort of bottleneck of history that we were just talking about? Mm-hmm. But if the answer is yes, then it's inevitable. I think most of them will agree that civilizations will expand and start to become star travelers. So I would say that the majority of my colleagues believe that there are spacefaring aliens out there.
Wow, that's amazing. I never knew that. You know, it seemed the more people I've talked to in the past have basically more or less said, you know, the opposite of that. And like it was just plain impossible, and that they did not believe that we were ever visited. And myself, you know, a lot of times you hear these ancient aliens things, and I don't think it makes any difference if it was 2 million years ago that we visited or last week, you know, as far as timing goes with other civilizations.
Right. I think, you know, the main thing that I'll point out there is the vast majority of my colleagues, I think, will agree that they think it's likely that there are spacefaring aliens like that. However, they're all skeptical of any claims of evidence that we've seen them. And it's really basically for the reason we were talking about before, that when you think of the level of technology that they must have in order to be here, it's so great that, as Alejandro mentioned earlier on, if they don't want us to know, I don't think it's possible for us to know that they're here. And if they do want us to know, they can certainly tell us anytime they want.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can only speculate why they haven't, you know, presented themselves. And, you know, I'm going to ask you a real offbeat question. And because I really don't know what to believe about it, and I'm on the fence about it. Abductions.
You know, again, I would say, given the level of technology that they have, if they want to wipe your memory after they've abducted you, they can. So it just doesn't make any sense to me for people when people claim the abductions. I understand that they believe what happened to them, but I think it's a belief that's been placed in their mind through their own doing. And, you know, that's just my perspective on it, because it doesn't make sense to me that they would abduct people in a way that would let them remember it when they got back home. In addition, when you hear the stories about the kind of technology being used on these people, it sounds kind of like our technology, not like technology of someone who makes us look like ants in comparison.
I have to stay neutral on the subject because I thank you for that. Someone wants to know if you can comment, I mentioned it earlier, on the recent discoveries to the Hadron Collider.
Well, the big discovery from the Large Hadron Collider of the last couple of years was the Higgs boson. And that's a very, very important discovery, because it is a particle that was predicted by what physicists call the Standard Model. And it was the one really missing link in that model that hadn't been discovered. So finding it shows that that model is truly on the right track. And also, because there's variations on parameters for the model, knowing what the mass and characteristics of the Higgs boson are allow people to be more clear about which version of the model is the correct one. What it doesn't do is tell us where to go next. And that's really the big open debate in physics, is how do we unify all these there's really two big theories in physics. One is quantum mechanics, which is explained by the Standard Model, and the other is Einstein's theory of relativity. And quantum mechanics works beautifully for very small things, and relativity works beautifully for very large things like the universe. But the two of them give different answers under some very special circumstances, such as the singularity of a black hole. So we need to reconcile those two theories in order to go to the next step in physics.
The theory of everything.
So basically, knowing the Higgs boson's real helps with the quantum mechanics aspect, but it doesn't tell us the next step.
You wonder if there's particles that keep getting smaller and smaller too. I mean, that is a possibility.
Yeah, although according to the current models, it's not so much a matter of size, because these particles are thought to be actually point particles already, but they're subject to the uncertainty principle where you can't pin down a precise location. The bigger question is, do we have the whole picture? You may know that some of these ideas that go by names like superstrings and supersymmetry, imagine that tied up in the subatomic realm, there may be additional dimensions that we don't experience in our everyday life. And some models, 10 dimensions, all wrapped up into tiny little balls that we see as three-dimensional particles. So that's the place where the really interesting stuff is happening. The problem is, again, we just don't know where any of these hypotheses are going to lead, because The theorists haven't yet come up with ways to test these ideas in the laboratory. And without tests, they're still just speculation.
We have a person on the in the chat room that's actually a scientist as well. And he wants to know what you think of the book, How Hippies Saved Physics, if you read it. Have you read that?
I did not read that one.
Have you heard of it?
I have not.
Oh, okay.
Sounds interesting, though.
Yeah. It's a less reductionist view of physics.
Okay.
Whatever. I don't even know what that means. But, okay, moving on. How did you, you know, it really fascinates me how someone like you actually became open-minded enough to think about this. And did you have any interest in UFOs when you were growing up, or did that thought cross your mind?
Oh, absolutely. In the beginning of my book, Beyond UFOs, in the preface, I tell the story of the little aliens that I thought were visiting me when I was a child. And then, of course, I also point out that one of my big influences was the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, that came out in 1968. And you can probably see that influence on me in a lot of ways, not just in my interest, but you remember the aliens in 2001 are indeed at that level of technology that makes us, you know, like the ants in comparison. And so that idea stuck with me all those years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another question up on the message board. Do you have any theories or opinions on what type of propulsion methods of advanced craft could have?
You know, that's a great question. There are technologies that people have imagined that could transport us to the stars, things, you know, such as the using nuclear bombs behind a spacecraft to propel it. There's even an idea for super lasers using the sun's energy to push a solar sail outward, or interstellar ramjets that scoop up hydrogen gas along the way as they go. None of those get you quite fast enough. And of course, every science fiction lover's dream is that we can get around the speed of light limitation by going through hyperspace or wormholes, as Carl Sagan used in the movie Contact. And those kinds of things are with technologies that you know, we can make up names for them, like dilithium crystals, but we don't actually have any idea how they might work or even if they're possible.
Have you ever heard of the theory of, like, bending space-time?
Well, yes. So Einstein's general theory of relativity tells us that space-time is bent. It is curved, and it's curved by the masses within it. The question is, could we do that on demand to make it curved so that two points that we want to go between suddenly become close together in hyperspace, even though they're far away in physical space? And that's what Star Trek calls warp drive. It's kind of what Star Wars calls jumping into hyperspace. So the idea that something like that might be possible in principle is very real. It comes out of Einstein's theory. But whether it's actually achievable in practice is something we don't know.
Right. Have you ever heard of the phrase that Ben Rich at Lockheed Skunk Works said, you know, years ago, that, or I think back in, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or something like that, that they had the key to propel to the stars? Have you ever heard that?
I have not heard that particular thing, but I would suspect he was probably talking about some of these spacecraft that are on the drawing board that could get us to the stars in reasonable amounts of time. Mm-hmm. You know, a couple percent of the speed of light, you can get there and, you know, to Alpha Centauri in 40, 50 years.
I'm laughing because it's still a heck of a long time. And I think
it is, but one of the things I like to point out is that, you know, so round trip, we're talking 80 to 100 years, and it's probably going to be hard to find volunteers for that right now. However, imagine that medicine extends our lifespans and we live to be 1,000 or a couple thousand years old. At that point, taking a trip that lasts 100 years might not seem like such a bad thing.
Piece of cake. Yeah. There was, and by the way, if someone did go there and back, the time change would be totally different by the time they got back here, as well?
Not at those speeds. No,
I see.
You only start noticing that time dilation effect once you start to get to an appreciable fraction of the speed of light, say 50% or more, before it's going to really mean something to you. And so if you're just going a few percent the speed of light, it's going to take you 40 or 50 years each way, and the difference between your time and Earth time won't really be noticeable. It'll be there, but it won't be very big.
Well, it sounds like we would probably easily beat the Voyager out there. I think I read somewhere that it's several hundred thousand years by the time it'll hit the nearest star.
Yeah, at Voyager speed, it would take about 80 to 100,000 years to reach the nearest star, and it's not even going in the right direction. So Voyager won't encounter anything. There's nothing along its path that we are aware of that we'll ever encounter. Which, of course, is what made, if you remember, Star Trek 1, right, with V'ger.
Yes.
That's what made that such an interesting movie, is because they used that fact when V'ger returned to Earth.
That's right. The carbon, they wanted to get rid of the carbon units, if I remember right.
Right.
Yeah, that was a good movie. Let me just pull up in the chat room I saw just a minute ago. Where do you think that science is going when it comes to looking at this subject of UFOs? Do you think that there's a possibility of, you know, we talked earlier about Chile and places like that that are taking it more seriously. Do you think that eventually, with all of our discoveries, that we may take it more seriously?
Well, you know, scientists, one of the myths about scientists is that they always work on really hard stuff. Well, actually, what scientists do is they try to find easy stuff, right? That's natural human instinct. So when you're a scientist, you're looking for a problem that you might actually be able to solve in a few years. If it's a problem that you're never going to solve in your whole life, it's not really one that you're likely to be working on. For number one, there won't be any funding available, and nobody's going to support your research. And number two, you don't want to wait forever. You want to get some actual results. So scientists look for questions that they think they can actually answer in a reasonable amount of time. So today, what the scientists are doing is they've said the questions that we can answer are things about whether other Earth-like planets exist and the origin of life on Earth and what that might tell us about life elsewhere, and the nature of life and what that might tell us about life elsewhere. So those are the things where scientists are putting a great deal of effort. The difficulty with UFO research is that at the moment, it doesn't seem to have anything that you can really latch onto and think you're going to get a definitive answer in a few years. If that were to change, then yes, scientists would be all over it.
Yes. Well, you know, you really explained it there. And I asked the senior astronomer of SETI, Dr. Seth Shostak, what type of evidence would he need to actually, you know, tip his hat to the fact that we're being visited. And he said that he'd need a wing in the Smithsonian full of evidence.
Right. And you know, Seth and I work together on our Life in the Universe textbook, so I know him well.
Did the subject ever come up between you two? UFOs.
Oh, we talk about it all the time. It's great fun.
I'd like to be a fly on a wall there. On the message board, we have, can you speculate advanced physics technologies with practical applications that we may see in the next 50 years or so?
You know, one of the things I like to remind people is that 50 years ago, nobody saw the internet coming. So I think any attempts to speculate even 50 years out are pretty hopelessly flawed. But we can speculate a few years and see what's on the horizon, but that's not really with the super advanced physics. You know, we can get a few ideas. We know that there's been work being done on superconductors, so that might play a bigger role going into the future. But yeah, beyond that, I'm pretty hesitant to try to make any predictions.
Yeah, I can see that. Another question. The wave/particle duality has never been explained fully. Do you have anything to comment on that?
Well, it depends on what you mean by explained. There's no question that it's real. We can see it happening before our eyes with very simple laboratory experiments. In terms of whether it could be explained, you know, I like to go back to the famous debate between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein, where Einstein was objecting to quantum mechanics and these ideas of wave-particle duality because they seem to inject probability into the universe instead of just deterministic, you know, one thing leading to another. And Einstein said to Bohr that he didn't like it because, quote, God does not play dice. And Bohr's response was, stop telling God what to do. And so I think the question of explaining this is maybe more a matter of the human brain than nature. We know how nature behaves because we've seen it do this. And maybe the reason that it sounds weird to us is just a defect of our mental processes rather than anything that we should hope to put into our normal frame of reference.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things you brought up just a few minutes ago was the time element in researching. I liken it also to, you know, I'm going back to, again, talking about dark matter and dark energy. You know, it seems like the time could go on and on and on to research that, yet people are involved in that, and they're actually, you know, there's a lot of funding available for that, isn't there?
There is now, but dark matter was – the idea first came up in the 1930s and was very well established by the early 80s, and there was no funding available at those times because no one knew what you could possibly do to investigate it. The difference is that over more recent times, people have figured out ways to investigate it that actually yield results. One of those ways is that now that our telescopes have become more powerful, we can actually use this bending of space that Einstein predicts to map out the distribution of dark matter in the universe. So even though we can't see the dark matter, from the way it affects space and light travel paths, we can map exactly where it's located. So that's the number one thing that funding is going to, is looking at the actual distribution of dark matter. And you get real and rapid results from that work. The second place where a little bit of funding is going is there are now some ideas about how we might actually detect the particles that people think might be involved in dark matter, so there's funding to develop experiments that have a chance of detecting them. But you see, it was only because the technology and the theory reached the point where there was stuff that could actually be done on that short time scale that the funding became available.
I see. Now, going back to the question someone posed earlier about the particle wave, he wanted me to be a little more specific in that, and it's the point is that observation of a phenomena changes the nature of matter. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. Observation, it doesn't change the nature of the matter, but it does change the situation. So the idea, the wave duality, wave-particle duality is just an outgrowth of the uncertainty principle. And the reason the uncertainty principle comes about is because, let's say, and I hope this won't get too technical, but let's say you want to locate an electron, an individual electron. Well, how do you do that in practice? In practice, the only way you can do it is by shining a light on it of some kind, right? So, but the light has energy. And when you hit something with energy, you make it move. And so the origin of the uncertainty principle is the idea that if you try to locate something really precisely, you're going to need to use really high energy light. But if you do that, you're going to make it move to someplace else. So you change where the particle is located or the way that it's moving, its position or its momentum, when you try to observe it. So yes, the observer becomes part of the equation in this wave-particle duality.
Okay. Now, another question up there, and I was thinking of something like this anyway. I was going to ask you what you thought about string theory. This question is, do you have any comments on the multiverse theory?
Sure. So the multiverse, string theory, all of these ideas come out of these attempts to find a way to reconcile relativity and quantum mechanics, as we talked about a little bit earlier. When we call them theories, it kind of bothers me that scientists call them theories because we're kind of misusing the word theory, which we always complain about the public misusing, right? A theory is supposed to mean something that has been well-tested and well-verified already. These are really hypotheses, not theories. The reason they get called theories, incidentally, is because they're mathematical theories. But physically, in the real universe, there's no evidence yet that any of them are correct. And so the multiverse and string theory, they're basically right now speculations that are nice ideas. They make some sense. They're mathematically robust, meaning that they're self-consistent in their mathematics. And they might actually explain the universe. But until we have any actual evidence for them, they're still just speculation. And my own personal guess, and we can contrast this with what we started out with the Big Bang. The reason I think the Big Bang is really an idea that's on the right track is because we talked about those lines of evidence that are very clear and incontrovertible. It's hard to see how you could have anything else other than a beginning for the universe 14 billion years ago. But with string theory and the multiverse, right now there's not really any real reason to think that they are correct, although also there's no real reason to think that they're incorrect. Personally, I'm not a fan of the multiverse. I think that we will find, I hope that we will find that it is an incorrect idea. But right now, we don't know.
Do you think it's possible that the, going back to the Big Bang again, do you think it's possible that that could be a cycle?
Certainly. And in a lot of ways, that's what the multiverse is. It's the idea that, you know, you have Big Bangs going off all over the place, creating different universes, and then they then either pop or collapse, and then they new universes pop into existence. So the multiverse is an attempt, in a way, to make sense of all that. But again, there's no actual evidence for it at this point. And I have a problem with it because it introduces the multiverse basically tries to say the reason we have a universe that's so perfect for life is because there's infinite other universes that aren't, and obviously we're going to live in the one that is. and I don't like infinities, and that's why I'm not a fan of the multiverse.
Now, according to what I've read in the past, it's possible that everything will just keep expanding till eventually everything just goes into particles. And, you know, is that sort of a correct statement?
So the universe is expanding today. We know that there's not enough mass in the universe to ever halt the expansion gravitationally. And on top of that, we know that the expansion is actually accelerating. So when you think of those things together, it sure sounds like, wow, it's pretty clear that it's going to expand forever. However, I like to remind people that forever is a really long time. And when we infer from current evidence that the universe will keep expanding forever, it makes perfect sense right now, but it will only make sense in the future if we don't discover any surprising new things between now and forever. So given that the acceleration of the universe was a big surprise when it was discovered only 15 or so years ago, I would not bet on a lack of surprises between now and forever. I think there'll be plenty more surprises, and any attempts to claim we know the fate of the universe are futile at this point.
Well, you said just a few minutes ago that you're not a big fan of infinity. So does that mean that you don't believe that the universe goes on forever? And if you don't think it goes on forever, is there a wall? That's something that's really confusing to me.
So in general relativity, the universe could wrap back around on itself. That's another allowed solution. And not in a place that we'd ever see. Our observable universe, the portion of the universe that we can see, would be a very tiny part of that whole thing. But that's a perfectly legitimate model for the universe, that it could be finite but really, really big. So, I would probably lean towards that explanation. And as far as, you know, my general viewpoint on this, you know, you have to separate between things that I can talk about with evidence and things that I just wish are true. And one of the things that I wish is true is that there's some greater force in the universe, whether it's the force from Star Wars or God or anything else. It would be nice to feel like there was some unifying cohesion to the universe that made it all make sense and gave it a purpose. I don't have any evidence for that, but I hope it's true.
Jeffrey, we got about just about a minute and a half or so. Can you tell the listening audience where they would find your website? And you write children's books as well, on kind of on the subject of astronomy and all that.
I do. I'll tell you a couple quick things. So you can find all the info on my website, which is jeffreybennett.com, JeffreyBennett.com. And there you'll see all my current books, including I have 5 books that are right now orbiting Earth on the International Space Station being read out loud by the astronauts in multiple languages.
Wow.
And that's part of a really cool new program called Storytime from Space. And you can go to storytimefromspace.com, and you'll also find links on my website to that. And I especially hope that people will check out my books, Beyond UFOs, which talks about the search for extraterrestrial life, and What is Relativity, which talks about Einstein's theory of relativity and the Big Bang and so on.
Well, that's great. Well, you've been tremendous. I've really enjoyed having you on the show.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it, too.
Well, that's it for the show today. I should say tonight. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. You can also check out links to our news and our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation in our forums. And next week, our guest will be Denise David Williams. She is a film producer, and she is doing a documentary on the life of Dr. John Mack. This should be an interesting show next week. And I'd like to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Our guest, of course, Jeffrey Bennett. Keith Rowland, who is a producer of the Dark Matter Radio Network. And Andy Fleming will be coming back for one clip a month or so. And Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for doing our music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember, you can like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news and astronomy news. You can check us out live next week right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to sign in our chat room next week at podcastufo.com. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high. We'll see you next week.